Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates one episode at a time, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which ran on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Corporal Captain Rob Kelly, and joining us this week in the VIP tent is Sean Ross. Hi, Sean.
Hey, it's actually Private Ross, so, you know. How are you doing?
I'm good. You've been demoted since the last time I talked to you, unfortunately.
I get knocked down in rank every time I open my mouth, so yeah.
Anyway, this is great. I'm so happy to have you here. Before we get into the episode in question, like, what's your history with this show, with MASH?
I think like many of your guests, we're all kind of around the same age. You know, MASH was fully in syndication when I was a kid, so, you know, we had six channels growing up, and so you kind of watched what was there, and MASH was always on at like 5 and 10. So it was always on, you know, after I'd gotten home from school and kind of come in and, you know, started eating dinner or settling down. And it was always on like right before I went to bed. So it was a show I really grew up watching. And actually, my dad was kind of in and out of my life during my childhood. And so we didn't have a lot of time together, but some of the time we had together was actually spent watching MASH. Like I just vividly remember it being one of the things at an early age that we sort of both enjoyed. It was like MASH and then Barney Miller. Like that was the block. And so that was what qualified as quality time in the 80s. So yeah, I have great memories of, and I think honestly, like you, it helped sort of formulate a good portion of my moral backbone. I mean, I didn't realize quite how much I had learned from this show until I started rewatching it because of MASHcast. Actually, I think I told you earlier, I'm about halfway through season 3. So I'm loving the rewatch, and I'm having some really fond memories of like, oh, that's where I maybe learned that first lesson.
It's amazing, the stuff that forms you as a kid. I really, while I have characters that are, you know, that I, in terms of comic books or television, I have characters that are maybe a little more beloved, but I really chalk up like Batman and Hawkeye Pierce as like my two childhood heroes. Cause like if they did something or said something that I didn't understand, I tried to look it up, you know, I tried to figure out what it was cause it meant that much to me.
Yeah, it was easier to have Batman as a role model when we were kids. I can't imagine so much now. It would be a role model defined by trauma and, you know, bitter outbursts of anger. So that might be a little harder.
I like to push everybody out of my life. That Batman's my era.
Me too.
Yeah, very cool. Well, I'm guessing, are you watching them on Hulu or on DVD?
Oh, yeah, I'm watching them on Hulu. I mean, once you announced it, and, you know, like most, I'm giving you credit for this, once you were able to convince a streaming service to adopt the show, you know, I started watching, and I was watching following along with the show, and then I, you know, I knew I was coming up to guest on an episode, so I, you know, got to my episode. And then I just like I couldn't stop, and it's really funny because I'm watching them on Hulu, and they're 20 minutes, so you can gobble a couple up in a row without even thinking about it. And my wife will walk into the room, and I'm, you know, sitting there holding the iPad watching it, and she's like, "Are you watching MASH again?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And she's like, "Okay, so I literally married my father." And I'm like, "Hey, that's on you. Like, that's on you, Elektra. That's not on me." So yeah, I'm getting a lot of weird looks from her, but I'm loving it. It's a fun rewatch.
Did you just say Elektra? Is your wife's name Elektra?
No, I called her Elektra, like the Greek myth where the woman falls in love with her father.
Okay, I was like, wow, like that's a hell of a handle for a wife to have, especially for a comic book fan.
Oh, my God.
Like, that would be amazing.
I would have married somebody named Elektra just for the name, but no.
Oh, my God. Yeah, your reference went right above my head there, but now I got it. Okay, thank you. Well, awesome. This is great. So the show we're talking about this week is from season 1, episode 10, I Hate a Mystery. Original air date, November 26th, 1972, written by Hal Dresner and directed by Hi Averback. This episode opens with Hawkeye cleaning up in a poker game against Trapper and some of the others. He's built up a tidy nest egg, which Ho-John keeps track of for him. During the game, Frank, who is watching disapprovingly, notices that the sterling silver frame around a picture of his mother has been stolen. He's sure Hawkeye or Trapper did it and storms off. He visits Hot Lips, who sees that her fancy hairbrush has also been stolen. A few tens down, Henry sees that the fancy-schmancy fishing reel he got for his girlfriend Leslie has also been stolen. It's a crime wave! The thievery gets so bad, Henry is forced to perform a tent-by-tent search. He ends up at the swamp, where neither Hawkeye or Trapper are taking him very seriously. But things get very serious when Henry finds all the stolen items in Hawkeye's footlocker. Hawkeye protests his innocence. Henry asks Hawkeye what the joke is. Meanwhile, Frank and Hot Lips are preparing the forms for court-martial. Hawkeye insists he's being framed and tries to figure out who's doing it, all the while being watched by a suspicious Hot Lips in the OR or radar out of it. It starts to drive Hawkeye crazy. Later, he sets a trap for the real thief by announcing over the PA system that fingerprints have been found on the stolen items now in Henry's desk. In the middle of the night, he calls a meeting of all the interested parties in the mess tent. Dressed like Sherlock Holmes, Hawkeye goes through all the possible suspects. He pulls a bluff, revealing that the real thief is Ho-John. Ho-John fesses up, but admits it was to raise money to bribe border guards to get his mother and sister across the border to where it's safer. Everyone agrees to let Ho-John keep the stuff so he can help his relatives. Hawkeye is impressed with how much extra money Ho-John has been able to save, until he realizes that total includes Hawkeye's poker winnings. So that is I Hate a Mystery. Sean, why did you want to talk about this one?
My favorite episodes, canonically, like in my memory, my favorite MASH episodes are actually the really goofy, like kind of whimsical fun ones, where it's just Hawkeye and Trapper or Hawkeye and BJ just at their absolute middle school worst. And so when you sent out the list, I looked at it, and I had really fond memories of finding this episode really funny. And so I wanted to cover it because I thought, well, you know, I'd like to address one that's a little less heavy, even though I love the heavier episodes as well. And then this one, like most MASH episodes, is funny, 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 and then bam, they hit you with a little heavy moment at the end just to make sure you get that little gut punch before you walk out the door. So I just it was an early season episode. And I really love those. I especially wanted an episode with Henry because he's my favorite colonel, or he's my favorite commander. And so, you know, I really latched onto this one. And I'm glad I did it. In rewatching it, it kind of contains everything I love about this show.
Interesting. Yeah, I would definitely say this is one of those early season episodes, early in the series episodes, where they're still trying to figure out how goofy they want to be. Because the third act, where Hawkeye comes in with the mess tent and he's dressed in the trench coat and the hat, that is very goofy, and it's something they really wouldn't do pretty much from season two on. And they wouldn't go that far where it's like, well, Hawkeye went and got a prop. You know, he did all this stuff, and, like, it's one of the kind of sillier elements of the show, and depending on whether you like that or not, but it's something they wouldn't continue on later in later seasons. So, yeah, you could see that they're really – the writers are like, how much can we get away with? Is this the style of MASH? Is this not the style of MASH? I mean, it does – remind one of the classic movie mysteries of the 30s and 40s. I mean, all the Thin Man movies used to end like that, where William Powell would just explain the plot to everybody and you know, point out the murderer. And Trapper even has a line where he says, somebody says, who do you think you are? And Trapper's like, the Thin Man? So they even get right that. So it's, I don't know. Every time I watch it, I'm always like, I don't know how much I totally am into this just because it's Hawkeye's being so silly. But as you say, they pull the rug out from under you with the serious stuff. Because then you find out that it's Ho-John. That's very sad that you didn't realize it's Ho-John. And he has that line about, I didn't think you'd miss all your trinkets. You're all so wealthy. And they show everybody, and they all look so sad because they realize they're bitching about their sterling silver frame missing or the fishing reel with the jeweled escarpment. And, you know, to them it's a big deal, but Ho-John's just trying to survive. And it's like you said, that line is like very meaningful because they all feel so sort of ashamed.
Yeah, the end is interesting because it comes a little too quickly, and you know, we can maybe talk about that in a little bit, but there's that moment at the end. That line for me rings really true too, because Frank and Margaret don't object when Ho-John says, you know, I didn't think you'd miss your trinkets. They're like, and in fact, I think it's Margaret's the first one who says, you know, you can keep my brushes, you can keep them. And Frank's like, yeah, and he doesn't complain. And that's so in contrast to the more xenophobic Frank we see later in the show.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're right. That's another reason I actually am really excited about this episode, because it's still in that, I don't know, like cooling off period of MASH. Because it's the 10th episode, but I think it was the 6th one filmed. And so, at least that's what it showed in my research, that it was a very early episode. And I love the fact that they're still settling in. Like in, you know, 10 episodes later, Trapper would never have believed that Hawkeye was a thief. I mean, he would have, he would have defended him, you know, till his last breath. And the fact that Trapper even turns on him a little bit and is kind of giving him, you know, the cold shoulder was interesting. And I love, I know it's silly. I love the Sherlock Holmes, you know, locked door room salon moment at the end. I Hawkeye for me, especially early Hawkeye, is just, he's a vaudevillian. Like, he's just a total, he's like the fourth Marx brother. You know, he's just a funny, goofy trickster that, you know, like is battling the darkness of war with just absurd humor. And I love that moment when I'm a grown man. And when he came walking out in the jacket and the hat, I like belly laughed. I was cracking up and I was like, okay, I'm like, I'm all in. I love this. So yeah, it is silly and it's not something they could do often, but I love that they do it here. And I love that early in the series, I like those moments in series when they don't know quite what they are yet. So they try a little bit more experimentation. So I thought it was great. I love that moment.
I like that he commits to the bit by smoking.
Oh yeah.
Something Hawkeye as a doctor would never do, but he even goes that far to have a lit cigarette in his mouth because that's what those guys did back then. That's really funny. What you said, you think it wraps up too quickly?
Yeah, the ending, I love this episode structurally. And in fact, you know, I think they do some really cool things in it, but where they go wrong, the weakest point for me is the ending. Again, I'm all in on the thin man moment. And then the reveal of it being Ho-John, and there's such a good moment. Alan Alda is such a good actor. There's that moment where he's fully committed to the bit, and he's just having fun. And then Ho-John puts his hands down because he thinks his fingernails are blue. And the change in Alan Alda's face from theatrical, I'm in the middle of the stage and have everybody's attention, to, oh my God, I'm crestfallen because now this got way more serious than I thought it was. It's so powerful. And so I'm okay with it being Ho-John. I like the reasoning behind it makes sense. And you're right, it drives home this idea of like, hey, these people are having fun and, you know, they're trying to make light of this dark situation. But as dark as it is for them, it's even darker, you know, for the Koreans themselves. But the quickness with which they all sort of acquiesce to like, oh yeah, keep our stuff. And then the little bit at the end where they try to make it even funnier, where he's keeping Hawkeye's poker winnings. And Hawkeye's like, what, you know, you have that money too? And he's like, well, I've got to get my sister and my brother and my cousin. And Trapper's like, forget it, Hawkeye, there's too many of them. And they all kind of chuckle and walk out together. I'm like, oh, that's a little colonialism for me. Like, that's a little too a little too imperialistic for me. The like, ha, 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 we're going to laugh about human bondage. Like, I just – I don't think MASH would have done that later. It was it's a miss. It's definitely a miss at trying to end on a funny note. And instead just sort of punctuating this little undercurrent of colonialism. So I don't hold it against it. I still love the episode. But yeah, the ending just misses for me.
I could hit it. It does feel a little flip that we are talking about people that are trying to escape war. You know, oh, sorry, there's so many of us that are fleeing from the north to the south. But, you know, we are trying not to get killed, Trapper. Really sorry that it's inconveniencing you or anything like that. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. Patrick Adiarte, this is an actor. I'm always fascinated by careers like this, because this is a guy that was in a bunch of stuff very briefly and then never again. And I'm always amazed that you can do stuff kind of as big ticket as what he did and then just disappear. I mean, he started out in movies in the 50s. He was in The King and I. He's in the original King and I. And that's his first credit. And then he did The Flower Drum Song, which was another kind of a big movie. And then he moved on to TV and he had appearances on It Takes a Thief, Ironside, Bonanza, The Brady Bunch, Hawaii Five-0, Kojak. The most episodes of any show he was on was on MASH. He did 7 episodes of MASH. You would sort of think this feels like it would be the last Ho-John episode, and it's not. He's in the next one, which is Germ Warfare, but I think Germ Warfare was filmed before this one. Mm-hmm. But he also appears in the next to last episode of the season, Ceasefire, which is very strange. It almost feels like they got him back just for that. And then he was in a show, and this – I don't know why I don't want to say I'm obsessed with the show, but there's a show that I find it keeps popping up in my MASH research, and it's called The New Temperatures Rising Show. And what IMDb says about it. It says, set at a Capital General Hospital in Washington, D.C., follows the adventures of the no-nonsense chief of surgery, Dr. Vincent Campanelli, and his all-nonsense staff. And the cast is Cleavon Little, Joan Van Ark, James Whitmore, and Paul Lynde.
Oh, my God.
I know. What a random collection of actors that is. And there's something about that name, The New Temperatures Rising Show. It's like, what does that even mean? That's just a bunch of words thrown together in a sentence. Like, that doesn't even make any sense to me. He plays a surgeon in that episode, in the one episode he did. And then after Kojak in 1974, he disappears. He doesn't have another credit after that. And according to IMDb, he's still around. Like, he's still alive. He's born in 1942. And, you know, like, that's, I would love to know, like, where is this guy?
Yeah, that is, you know, it, like, is strange.
It'd be fascinating to find, like, he's a part of television history, and yet he just seems to have dropped off the face of the planet.
Maybe the new temperatures rising might have just driven him from acting altogether.
Maybe so. I don't know.
When you said that title, I swear to God, the first thing that popped in my mind is Wendy and Marvin from the Super Friends, because I'm like, oh, they must have been on that show. Like, even as animated figures, there must have been a Wendy and Marvin cameo in anything called The New Temperatures Rising. It's just such a
strange title. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's so weird. But, yeah, but I liked Patrick Ediarte as this character. I could see why, again, as the show realized, they just didn't need all those hangers-on characters, that they just scaled it back. Because Radar sort of fills that role a little, as kind of the guy that goes and gets stuff for you. They sort of converted him into that. And so you can see why they didn't need Patrick Ediarte. And I always wonder, like, if you're one of those actors, man, you must really feel like you just missed the brass ring.
Yeah.
You know, to be on a show that became such a cultural phenomenon, and, you know, they hand you the pink slip at the end of the first season. That's got to be disappointing.
Well, and there's got to be that moment, too, where you're like, wait, Jamie Farr made it? Like you kept Clinger forever, but you let me go? Yeah, there's got to be a little bit of a moment. It's funny because, as whimsical and silly as this episode is, this is such a well-written show. It's a thing I just keep coming back to. I didn't realize it when I was younger. But, like, even the whole setup for the first act, you know, it is such a smart choice by the writers, because they're like, okay, hey, we're still a relatively new show. We don't know. This might be people's first episode. You know, you can never tell in television, you know, before streaming and before everything else. And so that whole setup of things being stolen introduces you to each character in turn and then tells you something interesting about them. Like, I thought it was really cool. It was like, you know, you get Frank, and the silver frame is gone. And so, you know, you realize that Frank is kind of a prude, and, you know, he's really attached to things that are worth money, because he emphasizes that it's silver, you know, which I know sets up your favorite episode, the Major Fred C. Dodds, which is coming pretty quickly. And then I love that moment where they get to Hawkeye, and he's doing that little symphony where Ho-John's making him his martini. And he's like, you know, he's narrating into all the sounds and everything. And you're like, oh, this guy's totally – and actually Lieutenant Bannerman calls him on it later in the episode. Like, he's totally a centralist. Like, he is immersed in his own physical experience. And, you know, as we watch the show more, we know it's his defense mechanism against going insane. But I loved that. As I was watching it again, I was like, man, I got a picture into every one of these characters in like 8 minutes, you know, by showing where they were, what they were doing when they realized something was stolen. It was just such good writing. I'm like, even for a silly, you know, episode that I doubt this is anybody's favorite episode. You know, there's all those, you know, Ceasefire's great and Dear Dad, and there's so many great ones coming, but it's just such a good bit of writing. I was really impressed. It hadn't hit me until I watched it again that I was like, oh man, in like 8 minutes, they introduce every character and they tell you what's important to that character.
I wanted to find out what you thought of the scene with Mulcahy, because this is the first episode where he gets any sort of extended sequence. This is the first time we see his tent. And they have this recurring bit with William Christopher, where he's trying to open the folding chair, and it keeps closing in on him. And I almost feel like the writers were testing out a comedy trope, that they're like, oh, Mulcahy's a klutz. Like, that's a thing that we could give him. That's a little bit of business. Now, they never followed up on it for whatever reason, but I feel like they spend a lot of time with William Christopher trying to open the folding chair, and it folds back on his hand, and he does it again, and it folds again. And because Mulcahy was so new, I felt like that's what they were doing. They were like, let me give him a little, you know, the priest is the klutz. I feel like that was some sort of business they were trying to arrange. Did you get that read from it?
Yeah, they were definitely going for a one-line description, right? Like the fumbling, bumbling, well-intentioned priest. And and they follow up on it a little bit. There's an episode later, and I don't remember the title, but where he has to deliver a service on the dangers of drinking. To the entire camp. And he just – he fumbles his way through it, and he repeats the same line from Leviticus like 5 times. And I do think early on they were making him – like, that was going to be his shtick. You're right. Like he's well-intentioned, but he just, you know, fumbles for everything. And it doesn't work for me on a couple levels. One, and this is unfair to them because it's, you know, they didn't know this when they were writing this episode, but the depth of the character to come, like the fact that he becomes very much the moral sounding board for the unit. So, you know, it doesn't really mesh with that, but I'm okay with that early on. But also, it doesn't play to his age. I feel like if they were going to go with the sort of, you know, fish out of water, you know, bumbling priest, they should have had him be like a brand new priest, like a really young, like fresh out of seminary, who has no idea what he's doing. And in fact, many of the things he's seeing them do that he, you know, should be condemning, he was probably just doing himself not long ago. So I don't know. I think that moment doesn't work for me very well, though that scene is really funny because I love that moment when he's trying his best to help Hawkeye. And he says to him, everything you, you know, everything you question you have, every want you have is in this book. And he hands him a book and Hawkeye's like, the dictionary? And it was just such a great little comic moment. And then Hawkeye runs before Mulcahy can even, like, he Commissioner Gordons him. Like, he, you know, leaves the room before Mulcahy can even turn around. And it's great. And I, you know, and this is also the first appearance of Radar's teddy bear. Like, that's
right.
That's a major supporting character. And that scene is so great, too, when Radar, you know, like a little kid is shaking his head when Henry tells him to pull his bedding up. And he won't do it, and he won't do it, and he won't do it. And then Henry finds the teddy bear, and he just grabs it and holds it to him. Like, there's so many great little character building moments in this episode. And I guess I didn't realize how new Father Mulcahy was in this episode. But that makes sense, then, that they would go for that, you know, kind of – quick shorthand to who they're going to want him to be.
The idea of William Christopher being a little too old to kind of do that shtick, that makes a lot of sense. And it reminds me of an interview I read with him, and I believe it's Susie Coulter's The Complete Book of MASH, which is a book I've mentioned a bunch of times on the show already. But there was an episode later on. I mean, God, we'll get to it 10 years from now or something. But there's an episode, I think it's around season 6, where they gave a line to Father Mulcahy where it seemed to suggest that Mulcahy did not know that Burns and Houlihan were having an affair. And when William Christopher got the script, he couldn't believe it. He was like, there's no way my character didn't know that. Yes, he's a priest, and yes, he wants to kind of believe the best in people, but he's not that naive. And he found a way, he said, to play it that suggests that Mulcahy was almost being sarcastic because he just was like, there's no way I don't know. You know, I'm not that naive. And I thought that – I think that's right. It's because of the actor. If they had cast somebody like 22 as the, you know, the fresh young priest, and this is his first time ever in service, then maybe you could buy that he's a klutz or that he's a this or that. But William Christopher just seems kind of like too dignified for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could see why there was a character beat that they just dropped after this. You never really saw it again.
Well, that's one of the things I love about his portrayal of Father Mulcahy is he is – I don't know, the best kind of religious figure. He's like, hey, I'm here to comfort you. I'm here to help, but I'm not here to judge, and especially not in war. And that's actually – he walks that line. I don't think I appreciated him as much when I was a kid. But like the older I get, the more he becomes one of my favorite characters because he really does walk that line between like, you know, I could be a fire and brimstone. You know, I could be sinners in the hands of an angry God, you know, priest yelling about booze. I could be Frank Burns' partner in crime. But I'm really here, you know, at the end of the day to help them survive this madness. And I'm going to do that, you know, in a much more comforting, nurturing, you know, kind of loving way. Like, I don't know, my Father Mulcahy moment so far is there's an episode, I think it's still season 1, where there's a serviceman being operated on and he's Jewish and he might pass away. And Father Mulcahy circles around and Hawkeye says something jokingly like, you know, I don't think Private Silverstein is Catholic. And Father Mulcahy breaks into Hebrew and does like a really. And I'm Jewish. And so he did the prayer and he actually did it well. His Hebrew was great. And I was like, oh, that's such a good character moment because he's not the camp priest. You know, he's the camp chaplain, rabbi, you know, imam. Like I loved that. That character and the betrayal where they eventually take him, I think is really meaningful. And so it was funny to see his first, like, you know, like, oh, I shut my hand in the chair. Oh, I did it again. You know, like I expected him to have like a honker or something to be like, honk, honk. You know, like it was just so, it was so silly, but it was sweet to see where he started.
Yeah. He sees his job as to provide comfort, not to push an agenda.
Exactly.
You know, he's not trying to convert people. He's there to use his religious background as comfort. And yeah, I love that moment too, where he seamlessly breaks into Hebrew. I think that's just fantastic. I love all that stuff. I think it's great. Actors-wise, I also want to mention there's Bonnie Jones as Lieutenant Bannerman. This is pretty much her last acting gig. She did a bunch of episodes of MASH, and then, again, much like Patrick Ayarte, disappeared. Again, I don't know how that's possible. It mentions, this is an episode where Hawkeye mentions the year. He's Tails Trapper. He says the Trapper. This is 1951, which, you know, that's a date that MASH never paid attention to its dates. There's an episode later on with Winchester and Potter where they talk about that it's 1951, so none of this makes any sense. MASH never kept straight of any of these dates. The scene in the mess tent where everything disappears and people get panicky, you notice that one of the nurses says, "Hey, my bag is gone." And I'm like, since when do the nurses carry purses?
Yeah.
In the unit? That's not a detail they'd follow up on.
Well, even that scene... The idea of Ho-John or anyone like crawling in and stealing things and then like taking Henry's spoon out of his hand and
yeah.
I mean it's the ridiculousness of it is funny, but the voice acting in it is so great because I love that moment where Father Mulcahy's like, "Oh," and then the nurse is like, "Sorry, Father," and he's like, "Well, you couldn't have known." I mean, it was just such great moments in that. And you know, the nurse Bannerman, first of all, that woman is classically beautiful. Like she could have been a beauty in any decade in the 20th century. Like, I don't know. She had that look of like, what's that actor's name? Myrna Loy or, you know, like,
oh, Myrna Loy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She reminded me of that kind of beauty, but I did a little research and she was married to Gene Reynolds at the time. So that might,
okay.
So that might explain both her presence in MASH and maybe her quick exit from MASH, depending on how that relationship went. But she was on some episodes of Hogan's Heroes too, which he was also involved with.
Right. they definitely saw her as somebody to put in fatigues, clearly.
Oh yeah.
That kind of actress. the title of the episode is "I Hate a Mystery." It's a goof on the radio show "I Love a Mystery," which was a radio show from 1939 to 1944. Now, I won't get too deep into it here, but if any of you ever have, if you love old timey stuff like I do, and I imagine you do because you're listening to the show, and you have a couple of minutes, go to the Wikipedia page and look up "I Love a Mystery" because there is a lot of fascinating history for that show, for just a radio show that's, you know, nobody. You know, it's just lost in the mist of time. There's a lot of crazy detail in there. I started reading the page just so I could get some background for this recording, and then I just started reading, and I kept reading, and I kept reading. I'm like, oh my God, there's all sorts of crazy stuff about "I Love a Mystery." So there's again, that's MASH referencing something that probably even by the 70s most people weren't familiar with anymore. Radio shows were kind of out. You know, old-time radio was coming back in the 70s in a kind of niche way, and it's back in its own way now. You can hear a bunch of these things on YouTube. But again, it's the writers are recalling something they remember as kids. The one other detail I wanted to mention, and this is something that you mentioned how great an actor Alan Alda is, and him and Wayne Rogers are really good at, is acting surprised.
Oh, my God.
And that's really hard to do. And so you have that sight gag where Henry's looking into the chimney of the stove, and he's like, "What's in here?" And they say, "Soot, soot, soot, sir." And he shakes the thing, and Henry gets the face full of soot. The way Alan Alda and Wayne Rogers react looks genuine, and that's so hard. You know it is, and you know they know it's coming because it's in the script. But they genuinely seem like they're laughing uncontrollably, and that's really hard to do.
Oh, that is absolutely my favorite moment in this episode because you can McLean Stevenson. You know he knows the soot is coming because he closes his eyes before he does the pipe. But clearly the prop master, like there were some shenanigans. This was like, you know, pushing Alan Rickman out, you know, not telling him you're going on two in the end of Die Hard. Like there were some real shenanigans here because I don't think the soot was supposed to be as prevalent. Like that was a Tarantino level amount of soot. Like it came pouring out. And you're right, their belly laughs. Like you feel like this is so dumb, but this is how I feel when I watch this show. I feel like I'm in the room with them in that moment. Like when Alan Alda's grabbing his stomach and Wayne Rogers, he keeps having that moment where his eyes pop, like he can't believe what he's seeing. And their laughs are so, like you said, they're so genuine that even though I watched that episode a few times to prep for this, I laugh just as hard each time. And then when McLean Stevenson turns around, it is this amazing look of like, yep, like one more way that the war has, you know, has literally crapped on me. Like one more indignity, you know, to face here. And yeah, that scene is fantastic. It's such a great, again, kind of silly comic moment. And I like actually the airplay that Henry gets in this episode. I like how he reminds me, like, he's, you know, he's trying to be a leader. He's trying to solve this crisis, but he's like a little boy who's put on his dad's suit and he's just kind of walking around in his shoes. Like, it just, it's so ill fitting. And it's a sweet episode. It makes him more endearing. Cause at this point in the show, they're still waffling between Henry being one of the guys and Henry sometimes being, I don't know, kind of an enemy, not an enemy, but like not necessarily an ally. So I like that we're getting a more cemented look at him as really just, you know, one of the best parts of the show.
Yeah, he's not comfortable playing the heavy. He has to sometimes because he's the commander, but he clearly doesn't like it. But yeah, he does get a face full of soot. It is, it's funny you're referencing of Alan Rickman. Yeah, I wonder if they did that. If it wasn't, you know, they told McLean Stevenson when it's coming, and then they do it a second earlier or a second later just to throw them. It makes me think of that scene in The Trouble with Tribbles.
Oh yeah,
where Kirk has opened the hatch and the tribbles keep falling out for way longer than they normally would, and you just know there were crew guys that are like, "This is my chance to throw something at William Shatner and get away with this." So they're just boom, boom, just pelting him with tribbles as he's trying to do his line. So it's really fun to watch those guys laugh.
Oh my God, that scene is great. And again, I'm not trying to write a love letter to Henry, but he's such a good actor, and the moment when he's in his tent with Leslie and he's like, "Oh, hey, I've bought you a little token of my affection."
He's
from
so
Tokyo.
Excited. He's
and
so
he
happy.
He pulls out the box and the way he says, you know, whatever reel with jeweled escarpment, it is pornographic. I mean, if you look at his face, he's licking his lips and it is so creepy.
So
it's so over-sexualized. And I was dying when I was watching it because I'm like, oh, he is the leeriest, creepiest old man in this moment, and it's awesome. And then she's just destroyed because I don't know what she thinks it is, but it definitely she didn't think it was going to be a fishing reel. So that scene is just amazing.
Yeah, she has the line about, "Oh, can't wait till I show the girls."
Yeah,
she's just like, okay. I think all us comic book nerds have lived that moment at some point where we're really excited over some nerdy thing, and maybe the significant other in our life is like, okay, because he just thinks she's so thrilled about this fishing reel, and you're like, no woman is going to be that excited about your super deluxe fishing reel. It's just not that exciting.
I mean, even the way he holds the box, it's it's a great bit of physical acting. It's just so awesome. Yeah, yeah, he is the unsung hero of this episode.
He's very, very funny. Hi, Averback, the director of this episode. He directed 20 different MASH episodes. He also did some episodes of After MASH, plus the Four Seasons TV series, which was based on the movie by Alan Alda and featured Alan Arbus in the cast. So it's another MASH connection there. He did an episode. His last credit is a show called The Last Precinct, which starred Adam West in one of his unfortunately quickly canceled TV projects. He was also an actor. In the 50s, he appeared in a movie called Cry Danger, which is a great little film noir. I've seen it. It's really, really good. I didn't recognize him because, of course, I don't know what he looks like. So it's kind of unusual to go from an acting to directing, but he did a pretty good job on this one. And obviously the producers of MASH were happy with him that he did 20 overall. And it would span over the length of the series. I mean, he would do episodes long into later seasons, so they kept bringing him back. Writing-wise, Hal Dresner, he wrote this one and one other episode of season one, Edwina, which we'll get to, which is a great show. He wrote episodes of Night Gallery, a Catch-22 TV movie, which
Whoa.
I never heard of. I didn't know that was a thing. The Iger Sanction with Clint Eastwood, and this movie called, unfortunately named, The Extraordinary Seaman. This was a fun credit to dig up. The cast of this movie is David Niven, Faye Dunaway, Mickey Rooney, which is, again, three completely random people, and a little-known actor named Alan Alda.
God, that's amazing.
I have got to find this movie at some point. I've never heard of it. I don't think it's available, but I have to find it.
Just the casts you've mentioned for that movie and for the temperature show. Like, did somebody just walk by Hollywood Squares and be like, "Hey, everybody, like, come along. I've got some roles for you." Because the Paul Lynde thing especially, I just can't even. Like, I cannot place Paul Lynde in this world. That is amazing. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mickey Rooney and Faye Dunaway. Like, I just – any scene they have is going to be Dustin Hoffman, you know, are you trying to seduce me, Mrs. Robinson? Like, I can't even imagine the two of them in a room together. Much
that
less
is
the
matter
movie.
And antimatter. Like, yes. That just makes – I'm trying to picture the craft services table. What do David Niven, Faye Dunaway, Mickey Rooney, and Alan Alda have to talk to one another about? Like, that is just – I might have to do it like a – I mean, I have more than enough MASH episodes to get to, but I always want to do like side episodes of like these weird little projects that I find through my research, because I have to see this movie now. I just have to. I mean, back then you could call a movie The Extraordinary Seaman and not know what you were calling it. You know, you could just do that. So that's just an amazing, amazing detail to find. I love IMDb. Thank you so much for providing me this rich, rich resource of information.
Oh, yeah. That is just begging to be seen.
Yeah, it absolutely is. So, yeah, I Hate a Mystery. It's a fun show. Again, you mentioned I love the seriousness beat that they bring into it. It almost feels like that was MASH's way of sneaking things in. I mean, they knew that in the first season they were being watched pretty closely by the network, and the network didn't want anything heavy. You know, they were trying to be goofy, like, oh, we're just doing a sitcom over here. Don't worry about us. And then they would slip in the heavy stuff. And they did it very well. And this is what it feels like to go from, as you mentioned, such a goofy moment to then something serious like that is, and that takes a lot of skill, because a lot of other shows you would almost hear them the script clunk into gear, you know. But they did it pretty well here.
Yeah, that the ability to switch tones is such a factor in this show that, again, I didn't realize when I first watched it as a kid, but their ability to dance sort of between raindrops tonally is just amazing, because then when they do get heavy, it doesn't come off as preachy, it doesn't come off as heavy-handed. It's so balanced by the comedy that it's really – I just can't think of another show that has done it this effectively. It's amazing.
It's a fun show. So, as I said, that's I Hate a Mystery. And, of course, you said you can check in on Hulu. Before we wrap up, do you have, like, a particular favorite line? I mean, you mentioned your favorite scene. Do you have a particular favorite line from this one?
Yeah, I think it's definitely when Frank goes – when he thinks that Hawkeye and Trapper have stolen his mother's – the frame around his mother's picture. He goes storming off to Margaret, and he walks in, and she's, you know, applying some kind of face cream to herself. And he walks in, and she goes, Frank, and he goes, you look awful. Hey, Margaret. And he just – it's just this quick little, like, again, totally oblivious Frank Burns moment where he just has no filter. And he's so upset about his mother's picture, and he's looking for a motherly comfort. I mean, even his lower lip trembles when he says, you know, they touched the picture of my mother, and she's just staring at him, and he's totally just insulted her, and then just blows right through it. So yeah, I don't, his delivery of that line and his ability to be the just face punchable sad sack is so good.
How he ever tucked Margaret into an affair, I have no idea, because he has, like, no game at all.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's just so creepy. I do love that moment where she sees that he sees what she looks like with her hair and rollers, and she just goes, ah! She's just upset over that. And that prompts his response. You look awful. It's like a nice job, Frank.
Yeah.
my favorite line is that when Ho-John asks Frank why he got into medicine, Hawkeye just mutters, to meet girls. And the way he says it almost sounds like an ad lib, and I guarantee that it wasn't, but just the way Alan Alda just says it offhandedly, he's like, to meet girls, it sounds like Alan Alda just made it up in that moment. I love that little detail, and of course, as we know, it worked,
because, oh yes,
you know, I mean, he got Margaret Houlihan out of it, so, you know, I guess it's a mission accomplished.
There's just one more, the when Hawkeye's tricking Henry into using the PA system to announce where he's keeping the things that have been stolen, and Henry doesn't realize it. And Hawkeye's like, you know, and if that's the way you want it, and he turns the speaker off, and Henry's like, that's the way I want it. And then he like turns his face, and then he just goes like, why me? Like, it's just this great moment of exasperation, because anytime Henry has to demonstrate even an ounce of leadership or command, it just takes everything out of him. And it's so good. It's such a good little bit of acting.
That's such a TV trope, that when one character needs to be overheard, so they start talking louder, another person will follow them and talk louder. And in my experience in real life, that never happens.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if somebody starts yelling, you're just like, why are you yelling? But in TV, people figure it out instantly. They pick up the clue immediately that I'm supposed to talk louder. I mean, Henry doesn't know in this moment. There's an episode later on where Hawkeye yells something out loud as a clue to somebody inside, and the person inside immediately reacts because they can figure it out, and that's just it's a shortcut. But yeah, I could see that moment of McLean Stevens of Henry going, "That's the way I want it."
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what he does. It's so like annoyed, but also like just he's so crestfallen. And the thing I don't know who did the makeup for this show, but I have never been more exhausted watching a show because they look so tired all the time. And they did such a good job of conveying that. And Henry in that moment just looks like the weight of the world is on him. And so I don't know if it's a combination of the acting and the makeup artist, whoever that was, deserves some props because this is the most exhausted looking cast. I mean, probably the only other cast that did this well was ER. I mean, they just look tired all the time.
Probably a particular skill because you want to make your actors look pretty, not tired. But that's something you had to do on MASH. Probably not everybody was, and probably something to do with the cinematography too. By the way, that's I don't think I've ever mentioned this person, William K. Jurgensen. He basically shot virtually every episode of MASH, as far as I could tell. I've seen his credit across like virtually every season. So he stuck with the show a long time. He gave it a particular look, and yeah, they had to, the show is not these characters are not meant to look glamorous. So yeah, it's a nice detail that they do. Everybody looks tired because of course they are.
Yeah, and it's so nice too because everything on the show matches that. Like I was thinking about this as I was watching it. It's one of the only shows where costume changes don't impact story. Like everybody's always in the same color and the same fatigues. Now, occasionally you'll get the red robe on Hawkeye or you'll get some weird kimono thing that somebody's wearing. But it's so interesting because I think the actors have to do so much more work with their faces because they aren't conveying some of the things with their clothing and with their costume changes or set changes. I mean, effectively every episode of MASH is a bottle episode, and so it makes the second round of going through it and then really going through it for the first time ever chronologically, you realize like they hit the jackpot with actors. I mean, it's just amazing how there's not a single weak spot on the show. It's phenomenal.
That's true. Yeah. So I Hate a Mystery, a really fun show. Sean, thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. It's always fun to talk to you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, man. I enjoyed it. Like I said, you've sparked a great MASH rewatch, which I'm loving. My wife isn't loving so much, but whatever.
Tell Electra she just needs to get into it a little more. Give the show the chance.
I went to Amazon last night and ordered a reel with Jewel Discartment, so that might reignite the flames.
So excited. You're not, honey, you're not going to believe what I got you for our anniversary. It's a flywheel with Jewel Discartment. So where can people – you do a podcast. Tell people about what podcast you do.
So I am a co-host of a podcast called Secret Wars and Beyond with Greg Arujo, where we cover every volume of Marvel Superhero Secret Wars. We covered the much-beloved Volume 1. We are almost done with the much maligned and much hated Volume 2, and then we will transition into the actually very beloved Volume 3 from 2015. I'm also the co-host of the Nerdy Dads podcast with Steve Medeiros, where we review some piece of pop culture that we loved as kids that we are choosing to inflict on our own children, and we talk about how we do that and maybe some of the things that haven't aged as well and the parts we love and, how we're going to punish our kids if they don't love The Princess Bride, which I think is good parenting.
Absolutely. There's some lines you just have to draw, I guess.
Exactly.
So, well, that's awesome. Thank you very much. I listened to the Secret War show, and I will start listening to the new show. I saw that you plugged it on Twitter, so that sounds really fun, too. I don't have any children, but I'm happy to hear about the pain you're inflicting on other people.
You do have shag, so, that kind of counts.
It's a good point. I hadn't really thought about that. So, anyway, that's going to do it for this episode of MASHcast. Of course, you can find back episodes of the show over on our network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. Check out MASH on Hulu, even though that one episode is colorized. You can still watch it. So, again, that is going to do it for this episode. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until the next episode, that is all.
Not really.
Have a seat, my son.
May I help you?
I've been hoping you'd stop by.
Queen.
Don't be deceived by these trappings. Underneath them, I'm just an ordinary man who is as prone to temptation as you are.
Would you like to talk about it, Father?